everybody. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Chief Judge Edith Jones, a friend of mine and mentor. Judge Jones earned her undergraduate degree at Cornell University and went on to law school at the University of Texas Law School, after which time she joined the firm of Andrews & Kurth. It's currently Andrews & Kurth. And while she was there, she earned partnership. She was the very first female partner at Andrews & Kurth. In 1985, then-President Ronald Reagan appointed her to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And when she was appointed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, she was the youngest judge appointee to the court. In 2006, she was named Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and of course, that's where she is now. I had the great pleasure of meeting Judge Jones when I was where many of you all are today in your law school career. I was a second year law student and I was interviewing for clerkship positions, and I was a very, very nervous second year law student when I met Judge Jones in her chambers. She was interviewing for law clerk positions, and I was fortunate enough to land one of the three law clerk positions that she hired for that year. Judge Jones and I have been developed a friendship ever since that time. She, the judge, has been a mentor, a role model. She has been a person of great professionalism and integrity in my life. I can tell you that I truly am a better person, both personally and professionally, because of working for and knowing Judge Jones. Over the years, it's been 17 years, Judge. Over the years, it's been a long time. Judge and I have developed a friendship and discovered that we have a lot of things in common. We were talking about a few of them just while we were catching up at lunch earlier. We share, for example, we have the same kind of taste in movies. We both love to cook, and we both have a love of family. Judge's newest addition to her family is her granddaughter, who was named after her. And when I learned that her granddaughter is named after her, I thought to myself, that's an odd name to name a girl, Judge. But then, I was so relieved to hear that they call her Edie. Judge is here today to talk to you about the Supreme Court and the nature of man. Please join me in welcoming Chief Judge Edith Jones.
Well, I won't belabor you by thanking Meredith at length for that introduction, except to say that the respect and feeling of affection are quite mutual, and University of Houston is very fortunate to have Professor Duncan on faculty as a professor, scholar, and role model, and I can't say much more about her than that. This topic was selected by Mr. Gibson. I offered him several alternatives, and this is a speech that I've given for quite a while because it's a good thing to raise some issues about at the present time in society. It comes off a little essay I wrote. It's in the old version of the Texas Review of Law and Politics called The Nature of Man According to the Supreme Court. And it, due to the constraints of time, I will just illustrate, set out my thesis and illustrate it with just a couple of examples, and then open the floor to questioning. I've been interested in this idea for many, many years, because although I was an economics major in college, if things had turned out differently at Cornell, where I went to undergrad, I would have been a political science major. And when I came on the court, I had the great opportunity and privilege to go back to studying the founding of the United States, because I wanted to know what is the proper role of a judge. The issue of the role and status of the judiciary and what we do in constitutional law has been a matter that has been preoccupying the United States for, well, practically since the founding in fits and starts, but almost consistently since the era of the 1960s during the Warren Court. And I'll try to explain a little bit of that in just a few minutes. But I think it is very, very important to remember that whenever you look at the role of the judiciary, and particularly the federal judiciary, but most states have their own analogies. You have to remember that at the outset of the framing, nobody really thought that the judges were supposed to control society, much less to determine what the fundamental mores and practices of the American people were going to be. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 called the judiciary the least dangerous branch of government because it exercises neither, I think it is, force nor will, but only the power of judgment. And at that time, what the judgment the judges rendered was based on a much narrower conception of issues that could come before courts. Now, undoubtedly, the idea of judicial review is built into the Constitution. It is actually referred to pretty directly in Federalist 78 and indirectly elsewhere in the Federalist Papers. But at all times, Chief Justice Marshall explained in Marbury versus Madison, with perhaps understatement or some degree of artful characterization, he viewed the idea of a judicial review as laying the text of the Constitution against the statute of Congress, and if they did not correspond, overruling the act. We've progressed quite a long way from that decision to where we are today, where we're debating the fundamental nature of the family and the organization of society as being issues that should be, to say nothing of the fate of recently enacted highly controversial legislation, is something, oh well, the courts are going to solve it. I don't want to solve all of society's problems, and let me tell you why. The genius of the American founding, in my view, is that it resides in two principles that undergird all of the thoughts of the framers. And again, I would invite questions when I'm through with this. But the framers were guided by two things. Number one, the new science of politics that had been enunciated during the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment saw the rise to prominence of thinkers like Locke, Montesquieu, Voltaire to some extent. It was later enunciated through Edmund Burke, although he was too contemporary. They didn't really read him. But the idea was that the ideas of liberty, of individual freedom, of the right to acquire the fruits and hold the fruits of one's labor independently and without having to defer to the rights of kings or the rights of the whims of Parliament in order to hold and dispose of one's property and to achieve one's status in life. The principles of the Enlightenment were embodied in ideas of, which were, they weren't novel, they weren't historically novel. The antecedents go back to the Greek democracies and then to the early Roman Republic. But the ideas of republican government, which is to say the consent of the governed, active participation in government by all citizens who were capable of doing so, and then having government adhere to the wishes and will of the people rather than, as I said, the opposite. So this was the new science of politics. Montesquieu was developed the concept that was crucial to the Constitution of a tripartite system of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, embodying checks and balances, the point of which was that no part of government could take over power, that the likelihood of usurpation of power is the greatest when those fundamental activities of government are aligned and combined in one or two bodies. And so that is the principle, the separation of powers and checks and balances that animates the organization of our Constitution. The judiciary, as I said, had a limited role. It is distinct from legislation. It is distinct from the executive power. It does not have the power to control the purse, and therefore it has only the power to interpret the laws that are given. Well, alongside this new science and politics, the framers were animated by something else as well. The Judeo-Christian world view. It is unequivocal. Some people, some scholars have attempted to say that a lot of the framers were sort of agnostics or skeptics or deists, and certainly there was that element of thinking. Thomas Jefferson perhaps represents it the best. But the Judeo-Christian principles, the Decalogue, that is to say the Ten Commandments, the principle, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, and all of morality that flows from that were viewed as essential to their understanding of what human nature was supposed to be. So they had an idea that people could govern themselves in a limited government, but they also had the idea that man is a fallen creature, that he often seeks his interest to the detriment of those of his neighbor, that the idea that people tend, once they have power, to want to amass more power unless there are checks placed upon them, and that the only way to maintain self-government is to have a people imbued with the moral virtue to carry out self-government, because once you lose the sense of inherent limits on your personal conduct, limits that favor the maintenance of a good society as opposed to just crass self-interest, then your government becomes skewed, it becomes perverted, it becomes a fight of all against all, each person at the trough to get his or her share of it, each person who's controlling what goes into the trough to have a larger and larger share of power. So you have these two principles. The theologian and political thinker Michael Novak wrote a book about this after I gave my speech, I'll add, called On Two Wings, where it's a rather short book, but it carries forth all sorts of historical evidence to support that these were the twin theories behind our Republican government. Well, let's go to what does the Supreme Court think about these theories? Sadly, at this point in our history, or the point I'm going to discuss, they didn't think about them very much, in my view. I pick, for where the Supreme Court went wrong, the era from about 1960 forward. And in order to, as I say, confine this because of the scope of time, I will say at the outset, I do not quarrel with Brown v. Board of Education. I do believe that the reasoning and the mode of decision making of the Supreme Court is in most respects highly defensible, even if not in traditional terms that I might prefer. And there are many good decisions that have been made. But I do believe that during the era of the 60s, which most of you probably are hardly even going to study during constitutional law now, the court went fundamentally wrong in terms of not only broadening the scope of judicial power and what judges could decide, but also in terms of the impact of their decisions. Why did they go wrong? Well, that would be another series of lectures to explain how the United States got from the twin principles of the founding, which to me and to many Americans, I think, are still there, but how the thinkers behind legal decision-making migrated from that point through the progressive era, through the early 20s, and the Lochner and the misuse of judicial power at that point in time, to the New Deal when everything changed, and then up to the 60s, which is really the font of the judicial activism that has governed most actions, many of the actions of the federal court since the 60s. So when you take constitutional law, I dare say you will not single out the decisions of the 60s, but in fact, as you will see, just about everything you study comes from the 60s because it didn't exist before then, because it was made up. Okay, well, let's let's go to my two illustrations. My first one is going to be the area of crime and punishment. Everyone understands, or at least most of us do nowadays, the need for society to have to punish and deter people who would break the laws. Now, I'm separating, talking about traditional criminal misconduct. I'm not talking about over-criminalization, which is a separate issue. But in the 1960s, when some of us were young and sprightly, there were a lot of ideas going on about criminal activity being caused by bad socioeconomic conditions, by unhappy family situations, by segregation, by poverty. The whole idea of crime was that the criminal wasn't guilty, it was society was guilty for creating the criminal. And this view of criminal responsibility deeply influenced the majority of the Warren Court, as it did probably the majority of elite academic and a lot of political opinion at that time. So the Warren Court decided to take things into its own hands, realizing when you think that the person who commits the criminal act is a victim of society, then you think that that person has to have protection against the punishment that society would inflict, and the court did this by adapting the protections, the statements in the Bill of Rights, which, as we all know, were supposed to apply to the federal government, not directly to the states. They began applying those provisions of the Bill of Rights directly against the states. This was extremely controversial at the time from a federalism perspective. Great justices like Harlan dissented routinely because the Supreme Court would take a case on direct appeal or on even worse, on habeas corpus appeal, overturn a conviction, and upset the entire judicial system, criminal justice system of a particular state or all the states at once, as far as that goes. Let me just, I made a list in my article of 20 different aspects of criminal procedure that the court took into its own control and constitutionalized during the 60s, ranging from admissibility of evidence, of confessions, the right to remain silent, the right to testify, just to mention a few, the reliability of identification testimony, the makeup of grand juries, pretrial publicity, double jeopardy, co-conspirator testimony, prosecutorial misconduct, speedy trial, and very importantly, habeas. And there are others in addition. So that most of our codes of criminal procedure now derive from decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, what happened at that time? There were many people who applauded these decisions because they felt that the criminal justice system was peremptory and unfair, and perhaps in some part of the country is racially discriminatory. But what happened? The immediate result was that the convictions could not be obtained. Convictions that had been obtained were overturned, and people who had committed crimes were thrown back in the street. We had a crime wave. By the end of the 60s, we had a huge crime wave, and that was one of the things that propelled Richard Nixon to the presidency. He was going to conduct the war on crime, and ever since then, it has been a big issue, really, of demagoguery in politics as to who's tougher on crime on the federal level. So this whole, and what happened was that society reacted to the crime wave. How? Well, by seeking self-protection, by dramatically and radically increasing criminal sentences, by wiring around many of these decisions that had been made. And the result is that today we have one of the highest rates of incarceration in the world. And really the length of prison sentences that are meted out to some people in the federal system, which I see every day, are really almost shocking. Society has plenty of problems, but it got around these impediments to convicting criminals by saying, once we get you through the gauntlet, you're going away, we're locking up the key. Furthermore, this sort of cat and mouse system that we've created encourages criminals in many ways to try to beat the odds because they can get out on technicalities. You all know plenty of cases in the public limelight where people seem to beat the odds and, on a conviction. And that encourages, I can't tell you how many others that encourages. I was told by a judge only yesterday that a new development among the convicts up in one part of our circuit is to go pro se. They don't want a lawyer. They want to go pro se because somebody has given them the, which means, you know, represent themselves. Somebody's given them the idea that if they represent themselves at trial and then represent themselves on appeal, they're likely to have a better chance to get out because all the courts are sympathetic to the guys who only represent themselves. Well, I think they're going to have a rude awakening here. But the whole idea that you would try to game the system by doing something which is plainly not in your best interest is ridiculous. And where does it come from? It comes from the idea that the system is porous, that not everybody is justifiably punished, and that you could get away with things. Well, in any case, you know, I think that in retrospect, a good argument can be made that the court could have encouraged restraining the whatever abuses there were in the criminal justice system of the 60s without overturning the entire system in the United States. And I would just point out that there are plenty of other civilized countries that do not have the exclusionary rule, the Miranda rule, and a lot of these other impediments, and we consider them to be fully civilized societies. So the court took on this then current philosophical view that it is not the criminal who is fully responsible, and decided to adapt that into its opinions, and the result was quite, if not a mess, a rather difficult and very complex system that we have today. The second example I would point to, given the limits of time, is pornography. Pornography was banned in this country by legislatures high and low until the 50s. Now, there were certain states that allowed various levels of pornography, but censorship commissions were very common. They did censor things like D.H. Lawrence, which to this day I have not read, and other, I believe, there, you know, occasionally something would come into the limelight where a book had been censored because it was supposed to appeal to prurient interests. And so by the 50s, you had an oncoming revolt sort of against traditional morality. Revolt might not be quite the word, but a lot of questions were being raised about traditional Judeo-Christian notions of morality. Do you really need to ban sex before marriage? Is divorce okay? Those very fundamental family-oriented questions. And part of that milieu was, if titillating literature or photos or something are displayed, what can be the harm of it? Well, you had a lot of men on the Supreme Court at that time, and the general attitude seemed to be a little porn is not bad for people. In fact, Justice Douglas even said at some point in time that, I've got it here somewhere, although, he said, I seriously doubt the wisdom of trying by law to put the fresh, evanescent, natural blossoming of sex in categories like sin. And that is in a written opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, you're a young group, you're a different generation than I am, and you've all grown up with the Janis Jackson tweeting moment at the Super Bowl, but you've also grown up with an explosion of child pornography. What happened was that in my view, the Supreme Court took all the restraints off of censorship of prurient materials in a series of decisions where they were just overturning convictions for pornography, or a few, that the only, about the only thing they upheld was censorship of materials that had prurient interest to children. But, I mean, there's a reason why nobody reads Playboy today. Back when I was little, all the little boys wanted a picture of Playboy because it had a centerfold with the naked top of a young lady in it. And 30 years before that, one of the best lines I have, as late as the 1940s, the most prurient material that was available to young men, according to one former professor of mine, was the National Geographic. You had to work hard to get beyond that at that time. So things have truly migrated, and I don't think I need to tell you that pornography is everywhere now. It is mainstream. The references to sexual conduct and graphic sex are everywhere. If you have small children, you don't, you know, you want to preserve their innocence for a period of time, but the predators are everywhere on the internet. You cannot believe the nature of the child pornography cases that we see before us, and behind most of those cases are victims, and they are little bitty girls and sometimes boys. And, you know, the kind of crime. So what, am I blaming this all on the Supreme Court? Don't misquote me. I am not blaming it all on the Supreme Court. But when there are no restraints, when the restraints that society has traditionally imposed on sexual conduct are blown away, evaporated, called constitutionally suspect, when everybody has the, quote, right to indulge in whatever perverted or excessive conduct and activity and viewing they want to, then what happens? Well, it's sort of like eating. If you start eating too much, you put on weight, but you also get hungry for more. That's why it's so hard to diet, because your appetite gets bigger and bigger with your waistline. Unfortunately, it's the same in a lot of things that we indulge in that are not good for us. And one of those is pornography. And as people get satiated, frankly, young men, with looking at young women of their own age, I mean, not, you know, to me, it's just unbelievable that young women reveal themselves in the way they do. But once you get tired of that, what's the next frontier? Well, who knows? I mean, we didn't have the child porn industry when I was growing up that we have today. And so what I'm saying is, the Supreme Court brought under the aegis of the First Amendment something that had never been under the First Amendment before. They call it pornography. They said obscenity is still banned, but they defined obscenity in such a way that it is extremely difficult to get prosecutions, and some federal governments don't even try. So about all, the only frontier you're left when you talk about this kind of market, which amounts to billions and billions of dollars a year, they're just nibbling at the edges of that market by going after the child porn, and that too is billions of dollars. So the court lost sight of the importance of the principles of personal self-restraint that animated the framers. I find it very difficult to conceive of John Adams or Jefferson or James Madison or Justice Marshall or the heroes of the American Revolution having looked at girly magazines. I mean, I've never read that they did that. And if they did, no, people thought it was shameful and not something to be communicated to society as compared to the atmosphere we live in today. So what I'm, again, is hit it once more. The Supreme Court went outside the bounds of its competence, which is laws written on paper. It interpreted the First Amendment in a way that had never been done before, that one could call, in overruling legislation, they were in effect legislating, and in approving what became the widespread use and indulgence in pornographic materials in our society. I have other examples. I think one of the better ones for this, I wind up with campaign finance, because the court recently approved the federal laws that, since Buckley versus Vallejo, has been upholding federal laws that regulate the use of money in campaigns. Now, if you say that the first issue here is whether monetary contributions are speech, I would take the position that they are. I think a lot of people would take the position that they are. They are the most effective way of expressing an individual's viewpoint politically if you're not able to get active and aside from voting. So if you say that that kind of expression is protected by the First Amendment, the court, again, invented this. I mean, Congress invented it. There was a reason they did it. But the court has upheld many of these regulations, only recently started to roll back a few of them. And what does that go to? Well, that goes to the question, how do we participate in our representative government, and what groups should be empowered to decide for us? And every time Congress creates a loophole, somebody goes around the loophole. We just saw in this period of economic recession, more money spent in this off-year election than has ever been spent before because of a recent decision of the United States Supreme Court. But here, it seemed to me that the people went fundamentally off the track, or you could take that by constitutionalizing a regulation of political speech, which the First Amendment was intended to allow fully. I mean, the First Amendment didn't apply to pornography or obscenity originally, clearly applied to political speech, because otherwise how do self-governed people reach the decisions that they reach other than by talking about and having the national conversation in times of election? So I will close and give you an opportunity to ask some questions here by saying that, you know, I refer to these old cases because I can't talk about present ones, and I don't want to. But I think it should always be in the back of your minds as the future lawyers and hopefully leaders of our communities, that whenever the fact that the courts say something does not necessarily mean that the courts ought to have the authority to say certain things. And another way to put this is, my views are considered somewhat not unusual among federal judges, but I have one point of view. I have several friends on the Supreme Court of the United States, and we espouse one point of view that is regarded as controversial in certain areas. You have others that espouse another point of view, and the other point of view is, you know, judges are the best people to decide whether we should have gay marriage. Judges are the best people to decide how our adoption laws should look. Judges are the best people even to go out on the battlefield and tell the guys in combat that they need to Mirandize the terrorists that they pick up. I'm not of that ilk. I just would like to convey to you that I don't think the framers were of that ilk either, because the framers had the understanding that each part of government has a limited role to play. My limited role is reading the text of a document, reading the evidence that has been properly developed, and applying that within a limited historical framework, with the understanding that ultimately we are a nation of self-governed people, and that we all have to adhere to certain principles, underlying moral principles and principles of self-restraint. And I, as a judge, and any other federal judge, deceive ourselves when we think that we always have it right as compared to our Republican government's method of making decisions that reflect the reasoned moral decisions of the people in general. So, thank you very much.
Hi, Judge, you spoke a little bit about self-restraint, from which you spoke a lot about. And it seems to me like one of the virtues of self-restraint is the fact that it's self-imposed. And I'm just curious, it seems to me like somewhat of a contradiction to have the government imposing self-restraint on people.
Well, that goes, I guess my view is that society, that's the role of government, is to, if you're either in the state of nature or you're in the political state, which is the social contract where every person is given up his right to do whatever he wants to a duly constituted government. And then the government, is through the representatives of the people, is empowered to decide. Sometimes the government imposes good restraints, sometimes it imposes bad restraints. But you cannot have society without restraints of some kind. And yes, I certainly agree that self-imposed restraint is the best kind and not a substitute for the government. And it's sort of an ironic, or it's sort of an unfortunate fact, that as personal self-restraint breaks down, then the government has to come in. If you have a society where not many people do drugs, and back in the 40s, not many people did drugs at all. If you have a society where that is something that is either shamed by society, or where people do not have the taste for drugs and do not indulge in them, then you don't have to have these huge sentences for people who are trafficking in drugs. Then we don't ruin Mexico for the sake of our terrible, unquenchable appetite for illegal drugs. So that you're talking about a fundamental issue as to what kind of restraint. There's always going to be a system of restraint. But the more you can develop the inner person and the inner sense of self-restraint, which you do through the mediating communities of the family, a school that teaches moral values, a community that supports moral values, and our religious community, the more you're going to need a government doing top-down.
Yeah, I've always thought that the Supreme Court breached the Constitution when they applied the Establishment Clause to the states and took complete control of religion away from the states. What is your feeling or belief on that?
I think that obviously Congress says that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law regarding speech or representing an establishment of religion or abridging whatever it is. I'm sorry to say. But I think there's a very strong argument to be made in that regard, but nobody on the Supreme Court has even referred to that, to disestablishing the Establishment Clause. And that came in quite abruptly in the 1940s.
I don't want to go off on a tangent of Brown v. Board of Education, but I do want to kind of reconcile it with what you're talking about and make sure I understand your position. Would you say that that Brown v. Board of Education had a good impact and had a good effect on society overall, but that it wasn't the judiciary's right or responsibility to make that decision?
Well, we have the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. No person shall be denied the equal protection of the law. And the first things that the Supreme Court did out of the block were try to disable that protection in Plessy versus Ferguson and the Slaughterhouse cases. So the Supreme Court, you might say, was a little bit activist because they knew what the Reconstruction Congress was trying to do. And to be fair, there's a whole lot of historical literature I can't get into here. To be fair, it is not clear that society was ready for a colorblind society, notwithstanding what the first Justice Harlan said in Plessy. But it was ready for a society with equal legal rights for persons of every color. I mean, that's what the amendment meant. So the Supreme Court took that out of consideration, and then during the 20s and 30s began very, very gradually to break down some of these barriers. I was fortunate to be invited to an event commemorating commemorating the sweep versus, you know, the UT desegregation case, Herman's Sweat versus Painter, obviously, a few weeks ago with the Thurgood Marshall School of Law. And embarrassed to say, I had not really read up on the case, but early in the 40s, Heman Sweat had applied to the University of Texas School of Law, and they didn't want to admit him, so the legislature, so he filed suit, and his suit went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, he was represented by Thurgood Marshall, said that the University of Texas had to admit Heman Sweat as a law student. So they did. But they created a separate law school, separate but equal law school. And he and two other black people were educated in that law school. He ultimately had to drop out, but in the meantime, the Texas legislature, this is all pretty shameful, had created the Thurgood Marshall School of Law as the separate but equal law school for the state of Texas. And Heman Sweat ended up being one of the, he had ended up at the fight had ruined his health, so he never finished. But one of those graduates from the UT law school that occurred in a little house ended up being Henry Doyle, who became a judge here in Houston and a very good, a well-respected practitioner of the law for many years. So sometimes good comes out of evil, even though one should not do evil to procure good. But the point is that the Supreme Court, little by little, Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP, were nibbling away at the edges of the segregation doctrines. And I may not agree with the reasoning of Brown v. Board, but, and in fact, Justice Jackson died before the case was re-argued, and he had a draft opinion that would have resolved the case with the same result in a different way. So, the time had come for the United States to act upon equality.
It seems like the crux of your argument is that the courts, the judiciary, should be very hesitant to respond for demands from society to change things, because when it does, there's a cascade effect of unintended consequences. What, in your opinion, then, is the best forum to hear these concerns and shift society? Is it the legislature? Is that where we really should try to focus efforts to shift society, what we deem acceptable or not?
Sure. Absolutely. Or the executive to an extent. I mean, but that's why we have government at all levels. And lawyers are very valuable in government at all levels. One more question.
Yes, ma'am, Judge. I've heard the argument that the government, the Constitution created a majoritarian government, but that the Constitution itself also retained the rights and the protections for the minority. It kind of seems that your arguments would be against that. Could you expound on that argument?
Say it again.
I've heard you say that the Constitution itself created a majoritarian government. However, the other protections of the Constitution were there to protect the minority, so Bill of Rights and other protections within the Constitution are more of a minority protecting, even though it was created a majoritarian government. But
it
seems that you may disagree with that. Could you expound on your thoughts?
Well, to the extent I'm understanding what you're saying, there was a big argument about ratifying the Constitution because the Anti-Federalists, a substantial number of the people interested in government at that time, which was most Americans, all 3 million of us, felt that too much power was being given to the national government. And therefore, they demanded, and Madison acceded to, the idea that a Bill of Rights would be created, which, if you look at it, is pretty limited in scope to protect the rights against the federal government. And therefore, you have the First Amendment, which protects against an establishment of a national religion, freedom of speech, exercise against the national, I realize sometimes, you know, you have this Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, you have Third Amendment, quartering of soldiers, then the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Sixth Amendments all deal with criminal rights against the federal government. So if I understand that, if you, what you're saying is a dead white man theory of government, I reject that completely, because the ideas of the Declaration of Independence so that all men are created equal, men referring to human beings, and that was the principle. And even though, you know, Lincoln didn't abolish slavery the day he came into office, he always, no society is ever going to be perfect. You have to move toward that. And I'm frankly a triumphalist who thinks if you go, if you travel anywhere else in the world, you will not see the level of personal opportunity, freedom, racial equality, racial intermixing, religious intermixing, religious toleration that you see in this country today. Thanks to the country.